You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, one of my favorite guests returns, Barbara Hand Clow. Barbara is an internationally acclaimed ceremonial teacher, astrologer, cosmologist, author, and Mayan calendar researcher. Her numerous books include The Pleiadian Agenda, Alchemy of Nine Dimensions, Awakening the Planetary Mind, The Mayan Code, Catastrophobia, and her recent fictional trilogy, The Revelation Series, which begins with Revelations of the Ruby Crystal and its sequel, Revelations of the Aquarian Age. Revelations of the Aquarian Age is the second of three works of fiction in the contemporary spiritual and erotic thriller genre. The quasi-fictional narratives reveal church revelations and esoteric teachings on Jesus and Mary Magdalene, holy relics, sacred sexuality, and art. Tonight, we'll be discussing the first book in the Revelations trilogy, Revelations of the Ruby Crystal. Barbara has taught at sacred sites throughout the world and maintains a website at www.handcloud2012.com. So let's welcome Barbara back to the show now. Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Hi, Lance. Good to talk to you.
Yes, it's been a while.
It's been too long, yeah.
Yes, I missed you.
Yeah.
Well, this is a wonderful book, and there's so much, you know, since I've read so many of your works, and I'm familiar with many of the ideas and realities that you're working with, I could see the working of these ideas into the fictional account, and it was just fascinating, and several of the passages that I found the most moving were there was a wedding scene between the two main characters. Now I can't remember their names, but
you don't want to give the plot away either, so don't.
Right. And yeah. Some of the instances of the light and dark. And, of course, the reptilian influence. And so there's a lot of meat and potatoes. And there's also a wonderful dessert. And the descriptions that you have generated are just lush. And they take you to another dimension.
Well, thank you. You know, and you'd have to ask, like, why did I switch to fiction? Because after all, I've written books about many dimensions.
Yes.
And to tell you the truth, I reached this point, I wrote and published nonfiction books for 35, 40 years. And I just got sick of hearing my own voice.
And then
these wonderful characters all showed up on May 2011 in the morning while I was sitting in my writing room, and I took out a yellow tablet and I wrote three or four pages with their names, ages, background, philosophies, etc. And they just came in all in a group. All of them came in that morning except one who came in later. And so I realized, like, here's my chance to have these ideas coming out through many, many people. And the characters tend to be very intelligent and very well-educated with very rich backgrounds. Some of the older characters are basically, you know, at the level of a magus or a magician.
Yes.
And, yeah, so that just gave me the chance to have really intelligent people talking about all the stuff that I'm fascinated with.
Right. I love that aspect of it. And, of course, the ruby crystal plays a key role. And it's a ring that is handed down. And, again, we don't want to give away too much of the plot, but it connects to other worlds. And the two women that are the main characters are perfect representatives of the light and the dark. And It's very lush and rich, which I've always enjoyed, the taste of other worlds like that. And you take us there, which is really quite something. I don't know if you've have you been to Rome a few times?
Oh, yeah. As far as the Italian background in this book, actually a lot of the characters in this book are coming from real people that I know. And, of course, they're very, very, you know, they're hidden, so you can't, no one would ever know.
Right,
and even
right.
even the, some of the beautiful castles are actually places that I've actually been to. And so because I was lucky enough to have that experience actually when I was quite young, it kind of went deep inside me and was just waiting to be described and waiting to be expressed. And so the background material also is something I've experienced. And then the other background material in the novel, basically issues of priestly sexual abuse and issues of the ossuaries in Rome and things like that, that material in this novel and all the contemporary history issues, those are all real and absolutely factual. So that when it comes to the point of the characters actually talking about something that happened, it's absolutely factual. And the way I managed to do that is one of the characters is a reporter for the New York Times, who works in New York as well as in Italy. And so that gave me the chance to have everything coming out of his mouth be absolutely accurate, and the reader can immediately tell that this is real material.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that was, that's kind of an unusual thing to do in a novel. One of the people I think of who did that a lot is Anthony Trollope, who was a 19th century English writer, political writer that I like a lot. But the reason that I have that backdrop in the trilogy is that I'm covering 2011 through 2020 because I believe that this is the turning point of going out of the age of Pisces and going into the age of Aquarius. And so in order to, you know, kind of track that 9 or 10 year period of time, I had to have factual background in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that worked out that way. And that was actually quite difficult to do, and it's especially difficult. I'm working in the third book right now. And the third book is covering basically 2017 through 2020. And, of course, I have to cover Donald Trump and different things that are going on globally on that level. And
oh,
can
yeah.
you imagine? Oh, I'm really I'm really having a hard time. You know, the selection of detail is just of critical importance because
yeah.
reality has exploded. And the reason I decided to cover 2011 through 2020 was because I felt that it would be important to chronicle what it's like to have the age shift into the next age. But what I didn't really realize is how it would explode. And so at this point, I really did call the correct time frame. I know that.
Mm.
But handling it and describing it, it's like, whoa, you know, this is really... they should use me, you know, as in medical testing for, you know, getting rid of headaches because I'm doing something that would give most people a profound migraine.
Yes, well, it does give people migraines just to contemplate what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yes, I don't envy you that task. And then, of course, there's one wants to... end on a high note, and you know we don't know how things are, how the collective is going to decide, because it's kind of in the hands of the collective human consciousness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I see a positive ending, but there may be several timelines that split off from each other. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know me pretty well, and you know that I'm a profound optimist.
Yeah.
And I actually believe that what we're tracking is the end of an old era and the creation of a new one. So that
yeah.
even though the turning point is as difficult as it is, I actually do believe that a process is going on that's actually very positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, in the only thing I found I could do working on the third book with Donald Trump, since he has to be in there, is that he reminds me of St. Paul. 2,000 years ago.
Huh.
And one of the things that I did in the trilogy is I'm using the transition from the age of Aries into the age of Pisces in a fairly detailed way, because in order to help show what's going on now by going back to the previous age change and showing how it worked, that helps the reader kind of have an understanding of how this process occurs. And really, Donald Trump really reminds me of St. Paul, who just came along after the time of Jesus and just said, just get rid of this, just get rid of that, forget about circumcision, forget about dietary laws, just dump it all and let's do something different. And I also, as you probably know from reading me, I'm very, very psychic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just let whatever seems to want to come through, come through. I basically sit down when I'm working. I go into a mild trance.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know the characters. I'm very familiar with them. I'm very close to them. And I just let them do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
You're definitely in touch with some very deep, multidimensional realms that are coming through you. There's no question about it. And that comes through in the... from several of the characters' points of view, mentioning that we are in a multidimensional realm, that it's not just the three dimensions and the fourth and fifth.
Yeah, yeah. And also, and I'm going into the lower dimensions too, like with Armando, the character who's a painter, and I'm really fascinated by how evil comes into the world and how evil can affect a person's life. And
that's
the reason why I needed priestly sexual abuse to be the background topic for Ruby Crystal, because it's difficult to pick a better example of evil than priests abusing children.
Yeah.
And so all the way through these three novels, there are characters who have experienced abuse and are going through are experiencing healings.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's the issue of what is actually going on.
Mm-hmm.
When something like that occurs. And we're in the middle of a profound contemplation of that issue right now, with all the various forms of abuse that are coming out. And as I watch the different phases of this awareness coming in, one of the things that I've been noticing, especially this last year or two, is I'm seeing a lot of signs that the people who were abused and have experienced that basically are really not kind of totally in this dimension. Like when those things happen, those things come from other dimensions, specifically the second and the fourth dimension with my system.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is the third dimensional person who lives his or her everyday life has a lot of trouble believing that it's real and believing that it actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so living during this time where the truth is coming out, we are seeing people who are suddenly saying, yes, that did happen to me, and yes, that's a real thing. And that's very powerful to watch that. Like, I'm thinking of the trial for for that doctor who abused all the young female athletes in Michigan, at Michigan State.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who I can't remember his name, but to have a trial going on where we actually could see the girls standing up there. The judge is a woman, and so she insisted that all of the girls tell their story. Did you see any of that?
No, I didn't. No, I don't have television.
Yeah, they've been running it. Yeah, you don't have television. You don't see it at all. And by the way, I'm very selective about television. I use it as a tool to watch something like
right.
And as you're watching that trial with him there, you can tell that he doesn't really realize he did anything. And there's an aura of unreality that's being broken as one woman comes forth and says something, then the other one say, yes, that happened to me too, and yes, that happened to me too. And it's all the way up to the level of the president and a porno queen, you know? It's just amazing.
Oh, yeah. And it probably will get more amazing as more is revealed.
That's true. Yeah.
Because, you know, this is the tip of the iceberg. We haven't seen it all yet.
Yeah.
and that and other things that have been kept secret by the patriarchy and the dark government will start to emerge, because you pull one thread somewhere and other threads are going to get dislodged.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And so the old paradigms are going to start crumbling faster, even though they look like they're getting stronger. You know, the corporations create a figure eight around the world, and you've got CERN and other colliders all over the place doing interdimensional connections, allegedly with some dark forces. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the early queens. I think Queen, was it Elizabeth? No, it was before Elizabeth. There was one of the advisors to the queen that was connecting to channeling dark forces that were mm-hmm. revealing a lot about, you know, atoms and atomic bombs and the reverse of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on. So this has been going on for quite a long time. And
And I think I have been brought out to bring in this trilogy to express what goes on with each of us as an individual when mm-hmm. we participate in this. Because as these revelations come forth and as these secrets are revealed, it's involving all of us. And the only way you can really understand it and handle it, as far as I can tell, is to look at it from a dimensional point of view. Like, mm-hmm. for example, in the second dimension is the realm of the tectonic forces that are between the center of the planet and then the crust of the Earth, the telluric realm.
Yeah.
And in that realm we have an incredible amount of consciousness, mineral consciousness, microbial consciousness. And what happens with that is that when our consciousness is involved with that, that's the part of us that's seeking healing and seeking the light. And then when we see these large forces that you're describing, like things that are happening like at CERN, when they play around with those kinds of forces, those are very, very high dimensional forces, they also activate the Earth. They activate the consciousness of the Earth. And, Lance, I find that if I can really be attuned to the second dimensional part of myself, and if I can really feel the fourth dimensional collective mind, if I can keep that as a part of me, it's not that it's separate from my third D self, my third mm-hmm. dimensional self, like you and I are in the third dimension right now talking on the phone.
Right.
But it's more that as I'm in my third dimensional self, that I can detect when forces and energy are like coming from the second dimension or when they're coming from the fourth dimension.
Mm.
And I've used this. You'll love this. This is a good one that you probably haven't heard yet. In a couple of my other books, I've often compared being a human to being like an Oreo cookie, where we're sandwiched between the intense dark level of the second dimension and then the fourth dimensional collective mind, and then we're like the squishy sugary stuff in between, you know, the two parts of the Oreo cookie. And lo and behold, one of the alternative researchers noticed a couple of years ago, and next time you get a chance, go get an Oreo cookie. The Oreo cookie, you know all those designs on it on both sides of it?
Yeah.
They're all Templar symbols.
Oh, my goodness.
All of them.
Wow.
I'm telling you, at this point, we get Oreo cookies and we hand them out to students in class because people wouldn't believe it. You know, and so as we're in this third dimensional self, we really are going through a crash course at this point in really getting attuned to how these other dimensions are affecting us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the way I'm doing it in the trilogy is the characters are experiencing that, and then you get to experience how they're responding to things like that.
Yes, and it's refreshing to be able to go through that and not have, well, some people will have personal trauma that will arise from their own shadow, but it's healing to be able to go through that with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I ended up in a higher place.
Yeah, people, when I go out and do book signings and stuff, people have been telling me that reading, that in this case, Ruby Crystal, was kind of like getting a really good Reiki session. Isn't that interesting? Yeah, people are telling me, like, why go get a a session with therapists when you can sit down with a book like this and work with all that energy with you kind of being the director of it because you're the reader.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Did you find that people initially were a little bit hesitant to see you working in fiction after so many wonderful books that were seminal to 2012 and the Catastrophobia? I mean, you have done so much incredible work that has actually changed things immensely. Do you find that the people who follow your work were a little hesitant to get into the fictional side with you?
That has been the case quite a great degree. And part of the reason for that is that nonfiction readers don't tend to read fiction these days because reading all that nonfiction stuff takes a whole bunch of time. And so when you have a chance to read, you want to go into a topic that you're researching or thinking about.
Right, right.
You know, but what I'm hoping at this point that people are going to start reading fiction again, because fiction gives you something that you can't get in a nonfiction book. You know, with nonfiction, you're working with data and you're working with information, but fiction gives you the chance to actually, like, create a drama, create a work of art which can actually move people in a very intuitive and intensely emotional way. And I switched to it because I feel that ultimately, well, let me put it this way, Lance. Let's say that you have studied English history from 1000 AD up to the current moment, and you have all the kings and queens and all the battles and all the stories. And then every once in a while you pick up a really good fictional novel about a particular king or particular queen, particular era in history. And if you think about it, when you try to remember all the different parts of the historical landscape that you're thinking about, the ones that you remember are the ones that you actually read a novel about. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And so it's a tremendous aid to memory recall, because good fiction takes you into a particular period of time in a way that doesn't happen if you're just reading facts and information.
Right. And, of course, the facts and information are not always accurate, and they don't cover everything because so much is wallpapered over. I think a while back, Father Junipero Serra was given sainthood, and there was a big cry about that because of the abuses that were done in his wherever he was.
Yeah.
And there was a big protest about him being created as a saint, and of course he did get sainthood because they do what they please.
Well, they think he's a saint. I was one of the people, by the way, who participated in that movement against that.
Yeah,
I wasn't actually there for the demonstrations, but I contributed to that one because, you know, he was an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and then of course we read all the time about the various priests who have a certain following, and they've abused children for years, and when there's finally a big outcry, they're simply moved to another location that's far enough away that nobody knows what they've done, and they just keep going over there.
That's right.
And so really this is all known from the top down. And it seems that it could be an example of how evil can penetrate something that appears to be of the highest spiritual order.
Yeah, and that's absolutely true. Yeah.
And masquerade, you know, just because they wear white robes doesn't mean that they're white inside or pure inside. And the chanting monks or the chanting priests down below, which is something that gets covered in your book, that's an awakening moment when you realize that things like that are going on.
Mm-hmm. And that's coming from factual information, by the way.
Yes.
But I can't. Okay, it's another issue with fiction. Okay, when you're doing nonfiction, everything has to be absolutely sourced and bibliographies and notes and all that kind of stuff. And you can't say anything. If you say something that's an opinion, you have to say this is what I think or whatever
right.
you want to do with that. But in fiction, in my case, over the last 45 years, because I've traveled a lot and I've met a lot of people have shared a lot of really amazing stuff with me. And people who know me know that I'm impeccable, and they know that I will never say they said it. They know that.
Right.
So what fiction has allowed me to do is it has allowed me to report on some things that I know are true because people have told me about their experiences. But of course, because it's fiction, I don't have to say Father so and so told me that and give a date and stuff like that. So it actually, in this case in particular, for fans of mine who like my nonfiction, there's a lot more information in this trilogy than there will ever be in a nonfiction book.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you can count, you can know intuitively that that certain things are coming from the truth. When I read through these things, I just know when certain things are mentioned that they are true and that I don't have to research them. You have done the homework and you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. That's true.
But they could be researched and then you'd find out, yeah, that's exactly what happened. Is there a particular, what do you feel brings you the most gratification about this book? What really makes you happy about the messages that you're sharing?
What makes me happy is the characters.
Mm-hmm,
because for me, good fiction is good characters.
Oh,
and
yes.
this is something that we've really gotten away from for the last 50, 60 years. And so if I can completely develop the deep psychology of a group of characters over a period of a trilogy, over a trilogy, that really makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're my friends.
Yeah.
I'm never lonely.
Yes, well, they're so rich. And, all the good stories are character-driven. And, of course, you being shamanic, having a shamanic background, you know that in ancient times, storytelling was the way that the elders and the shamans shared with the younger ones. And the stories revealed deep truths, but they were exciting for the children to hear and the adults to hear too. And we've lost our storytelling.
Yeah,
and it's kids looking at the iPhone screens and getting the latest gadgets and things. We're getting lost in a virtual reality, and we're losing the ability to imagine and to imagineer things that are just presented to us as fact through technology.
Yeah, so this is kind of, we could look at this from two points of view. I'll start with the simple point of view first, which would be that when you create characters and when you create a story, that gives me the opportunity to play around with the fact that what we think about creates reality, if you see what I mean. So through the characters, we can see them creating reality. And, there's an old New Age saying that we create our own reality and all that, but people don't really understand that very well. And so this is kind of a great opportunity to explore how we create our reality with our thoughts.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that's going on with storytelling is we have characters from two generations. We have a group of characters who are around 60 to 70 years old, and then we have a group of characters who are more or less in their 30s and 40s. And this is a group of characters, it's parents and children, so these are families.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just so happens that the older characters are magus. The older characters are shamans, they're teachers. And so in the trilogy, the older characters are passing their wisdom down to the younger people. And this is, of course, this is how reality, this is how wisdom used to be passed. And I am having a wonderful time just doing it again.
Well, you know, there's been prophecies, the Fatima prophecies, I think it was called, and that's mentioned in your book. And I think that the Father Malachi brought some of these to light, and he meticulously predicted what would happen with all of the popes, and so far he's been accurate. And if that's true, it looks like this is the could be the last pope and the end of organized religion. Do you think that we're seeing something like that happening, or?
I think we're definitely seeing something like that happening, for sure. And, of course, I'm chronicling it. That's why I chose this period of time. But I don't think religion's going to go away. As far as I can tell, now I've gone back and explored the change of the ages back thousands of years. Like, I've gone back as far as the age of Cancer and the age of Leo, which is 12, 14,000 years ago. And I've done that by time traveling, by doing past lives under hypnosis. That's the material. The Mind Chronicles trilogy that came out in the 80s and 90s, and now it's a three-book trilogy, but now it's in one book called The Mind Chronicles.
Right.
And I time-traveled over basically 100,000 years. And
oh, wow.
While I was doing that, I ran into the transitions, like from the special in one chapter, the age of Cancer moving into the age of Gemini. And so I'm losing my train of thought here. What were we talking about?
Well,
that was background.
The end of the church, of organized religion.
Yeah, okay, yeah, right. So, thank you. So as I've gone back, there's always religions and there's always belief systems that people are dealing with, but what happens when the ages change is they transform. They don't go away, they just transform. And so what will happen, and this is a statement I can make that I feel very confident about, is that during the age of Pisces from approximately 100 BC up to about 2000 AD, the age of Pisces was the development of organized religions. And in this case, I'm mainly working with Islam and Judaism and Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And so the age of organized religions was all about taking all the spirituality into a particular religion and then giving back to the people what you felt like giving to them so that you could control them.
Mm-hmm.
And the age of Aquarius is going to be all about each one of us having the opportunity to get in touch with high spiritual dimensions and realms on our own. And so what will happen is that the religions that allow people to pursue spirituality and allow people to explore contact with higher realms, they will continue. I can even imagine Catholicism actually going in that direction, because Catholicism actually has some very rich spiritual traditions that have been very, very inhibited. I mean, think of the Middle Ages and think of the spirituality of the Middle Ages. So I think that the Catholic Church actually has a background that could bring that forward, but they're going to have to stop trying to control everybody. For example, the hierarchy has to go.
Mm-hmm.
The male hierarchy has
right.
to go, and we're going to have to have women priests, and we're
yep.
going to have priests being married. All of that stuff is going to have to change, and I actually think that it will.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't, the church is going to cease to exist, because families are not going to raise their children anymore so that they can grow up to be altar boys who get abused. I mean, you know,
right?
You know, if you want the answer for why the church resists birth control, maybe they're trying to make sure there's plenty of children for them. I mean, you can't help.
Yes,
but
I've thought of that.
I know I shouldn't say that, but
well, it certainly is possible.
Well, it's so insane for the church to resist birth control, because
yeah.
what they need to do is they need to deal with abortion, which for them is a central issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, and then, of course, the patriarchy has to somehow to be dissolved, and the divine feminine has to resurge because it's been suppressed for so long.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think we see many, many signs of that happening. That's one of the reasons that Jesus and Mary Magdalene are a big topic. And, of course, that's more so in the second book, where we want to watch out for going up to the second novel, because in Revelations of the Aquarian Age, Jesus and Mary Magdalene become a very, very big factor. And so another transformation that we're going to need to see is our understanding of who Jesus was. And the patriarchy is all based on the idea that he was a celibate male, and then they based their whole system on the idea that he was a celibate male. He wasn't.
Right.
He was married. Anybody who knows anything about Judaism and what goes on with rabbis, he was married and he had a family.
And yes. And supposedly the Mary ran the church for a while. Wasn't she in another country, and she was quite powerful, and then they, I think they had to conceal the children because there was some kind of thrust to gain access to the royal, you know, their lineage.
Yeah.
And so who knows, it'd be interesting to find out what happened to their children.
Yeah, so of course I'm after that one like crazy all the way through the trilogy, and the issue of the Templars.
Yeah.
And as you know, there are many, many versions of how this story works out, and where the children were, and there's all kinds of rich fields
of
information here. But what I'm trying to do in this trilogy is prove that he was married and had a family. And so that's why I'm after the Talpiot tomb. Because what's coming up in the first and second book is the Jesus family tomb, which has now been authenticated.
This
has been scientifically authenticated. So of course Simon is researching it, the New York Times reporter.
Right.
And he's after the facts on this. But this is the most incredible news of the last 500 years.
Well, you would think that it would be. On every front page that exists.
Yeah, but see, it was, by the way, when the first discoveries are coming in back in the 1980s, and then around 2000, the James ossuary that was viewed in Canada. So this actually has been, it is so interesting, actually. It's been in many, many major newspapers, but what happens for people is they can't believe it. We're at that point where people hear that, but they can't believe it. And so,
right.
So what I did in my case is I really brought in all of the facts. We even have the DNA of Jesus.
Wow, that's amazing.
Nobody has released. They have the DNA, and they haven't sequenced it yet, as far as I know.
Oh, okay.
I follow that as close as I can. But we have all this. This is like the most incredible thing that anybody could tell you, if you know what I mean.
Oh,
and but your first response to it is it just fades out of people's brains because they can't imagine it. And so that's why I went after this so heavily in the trilogy, is by hearing the characters talking about it and hearing how they respond to this news. And, of course, the characters, for example, if Simon is talking about a particular issue, like the ossuaries in the Jesus family tomb, then he mentions, like, who he's reading. In other words, I have another issue in writing. If I'm going to use somebody's information, I always want to credit them.
Yeah.
And so what will happen with the trilogy, people are telling me this is going on, is then they read that the characters read this guy, then they go out and they get that person's book.
Yes, I had the same thought. I was taking notes on two of the people mentioned by one of the characters, and I was planning on going back and checking their work because it was very highly touted by the character.
Yeah, and Simcha Jakubovic, he is one of these people, I'm sure. And he is Simcha Jakubovic, is one of the major writers on the Jesus family tomb. And he has also done a film on the Jesus family tomb with James Cameron. And James Cameron is the director of Avatar.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so you can't go much further for credibility.
Right.
Yeah, but people, even I saw that on PBS, that the film of the Jesus Family Tomb. And I even forgot that James Cameron was involved in it until a couple of years later.
Wow.
And this should be the big news.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it may be. I mean, there may be a revival.
Well, I think a whole lot of people are going after this just the way I am. I mean, I'm just going after it because it's like, it's exciting.
Yeah, right. It's like the Sherlock Holmes discovering, you know, new information. Everybody loves a good mystery. And if this world holds nothing else, it contains many mysteries.
Yeah. And then there's this guy, Father Bugatti, Simon's researching, because he found the ossuaries of let's see, St. Peter, Lazarus. There's a bunch of these that he found that are locked up in a museum, in like a some kind of sepulchre someplace. And then the minute the Vatican got wind of what he was finding, they shut him up.
Right.
Yeah, right. You know, but it's not going to go away because, of course, according to the Vatican, St. Peter is under the Vatican. He's not. He's in Jerusalem in a box.
Wow.
So I had a lot of fun with this stuff, to tell you the truth. In fact, this kind of information has been piling up in my brain for like 30 years, you know, 40
years.
Time
for a brain dump.
Well, they found the Talpiot tomb in 1980. And then right after that, they found a second tomb in the Talpiot region, which probably is the tomb of the family of Joseph of Arimathea.
Wow.
And so for me, those things, I kept waiting, okay, this is what happened. Now, when's it going to come out? When are people going to find out? But, boy, the Vatican doesn't have any trouble squelching information.
Oh, no. They're real good at it.
Yeah, right.
And we both know that they hold acres of evidence of remarkable things from the past because they've collected it and stored it away. And I'm guessing that a lot of that has to do with extraterrestrial devices as well.
Yeah, and boy, that's the next thing that's going to come out, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's getting so close at this point. I know you're seeing the same thing, just different edges are coming forth. They're not going to be able to keep that quiet much longer.
Well, look at Antarctica. You know, there was a politician that went there, and he came out with a heart attack or something, and another major person that would be known went there, and he was rushed out as well. And they say that there's an ancient civilization that may have been Atlantis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, there could be ships underneath the ground. Who knows? But one can know that the major players are all there guarding it and researching it and tearing it apart and getting the goodies before it comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, and this cover-up can't function once the secrecy is broken.
Yeah.
So that's what we're right in the middle of, just everywhere. And there's so much of it going on. It's overwhelming, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
And it's barely gotten started. So if we're overwhelmed now, we're going to be really surprised when it just starts pouring out, when the dam breaks.
Well, you know, those of us who have done a lot of research throughout our lives, which you and I both have, we already know a lot of this.
Right.
So for us, it's going to be more like watching what happens once people start to get the truth.
Yes.
You know. Okay, so what's the big problem if extraterrestrials have been involved with the Earth?
Right. We may all be extraterrestrial.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what is the big problem? And so what I'm noticing, I'm having a lot of fun. I was turned 75 on Valentine's Day. So I'm a qualified elder at this point.
Yes, you are.
And, you know, I am. I'm a qualified elder.
Really?
And so hopefully my memory won't give out. But, but what I'm having fun with is passing wisdom now to younger people.
Oh, I love
it. And in different ways. I'm doing it with helping people do this, you know, all that stuff you can imagine. And I write forwards for people, whatever I can do. And what I'm finding is with the next generation, they're much freer with what they know than I was. I'm one of the ones who had to fight the old paradigm. And I'm one of the ones, like catastrophophobia and the issue of a cataclysm 11,500, 12,000 years ago. I'm one of those people who had to spend years doing research on science to prove that that actually happened. And then with the next generation, they just say, oh, yeah, sure.
Right. Right.
And so then it's, what's really fun is they don't need to argue about it. In fact, they basically never footnote or credit anybody anymore because they don't care about that. They're just going ahead with more accurate information. And something really powerful happens for you when the paradigm and the timeline that you're working with is accurate. Because through my education as a child and into college and all that, I was you should see what my books look like. And I have a really big library. And I have all these books on the old paradigm and the old story that I was forced to study.
Uh-huh.
And then the margins, in the margins of all my books, I've written the correct story.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
nice.
And I did that for years and years and years just to keep my own brain straight.
Right.
Well, we don't have to do that anymore.
Right.
You know, so with extraterrestrials, all the people who are younger than the generation below you and me, they all know that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not going to have any problem with it when the information actually comes out.
Right.
So what?
What was the big deal in the first place?
Oh, it was a big deal in the first place, sure.
Well, and then, of course, the secrecy then creates more of a need for secrecy, and then it becomes vital because there's so many things that are secret that that nothing can be revealed, so everything is above top secret at some point.
Yeah, and it's very funny because you know how they wouldn't give Jared Kushner a security clearance.
Mm-hmm.
Jared Kushner is of course Trump's son-in-law. And he's the guy who's trying to create a new situation in Jerusalem and in Israel. And Jared Kushner's really uptight because 90% of the information in the government is classified top secret.
Right.
So
right.
nobody can function in the government who doesn't have a security clearance.
Right.
So you've got this group of people with the security clearance. And then they're the ones who can operate and function, where anybody who doesn't have it basically is completely helpless, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of Jerusalem, it seems that there's talk about the Israelis building that temple that is supposed to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been brought up. And it looks like I get the sense that there is a kind of a move in that direction to allow that to happen.
Definitely.
One of the prophetic things is supposed to unravel as time passes.
Yeah, definitely. That's what's going on. That's why they're moving the embassy and different things like that. Oh, they definitely have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they're going to get away with it.
Well, let us hope not.
I mean, all we can do is watch what they're planning, but I
right.
don't think they can get away with it. But here's an interesting example of where this can get to be critically important. I'm convinced my work with catastrophobia and earth changes and cycles has continued. And so I keep tabs on all the latest information and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I've become convinced that the thermohaline current has stopped. Now, this is the current
Ooh.
That the current that carries the warm water up along the East Coast and then up around Greenland and then over to Europe. And I've been watching this data now for 15 years. The first announcement that the current might be slowing down came out in Forbes magazine in 2004.
Uh-huh.
And I can practically remember the day I saw Forbes magazine as clearly as I remember the day that John F. Kennedy was shot.
Oh,
because of the implications of this. Now, what's happening at this point, Lance, in terms of scientific information, it's pretty certain that's what's going on, and it's pretty certain that's why the weather is so difficult in the eastern United States and in Europe this year. Now, this is information that people need.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a story of major proportions. You would think that this is what you would hear if you turn on NBC News.
Right.
You don't hear it.
You don't, no.
Yeah. No.
Not a peep.
And why don't you hear about it? Because the big boys want to move their businesses and their housing situations into different climates in order to cope with this.
Yeah.
So what's going on right now is there's a lot of covert movement going on.
Yes.
And then a lot of talk about climate change. That distracts people. Let's talk about climate change.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and let's blame it on humans burning carbons in the atmosphere.
Well, right.
And by the way, I'm totally opposed to burning carbons in the atmosphere. I don't want you to think that I don't think that's an issue, because I think it's a really big issue. But I think that the whole climate change thing and Al Gore and all that stuff, I think it's all a cover-up for the fact that a cycle is in place and it's happening.
Yes, I agree with you. And also that you have the other factors that DARPA and the various military groups want to control the weather by 2025. Well, they already have a good handle on controlling the weather, and there are weather wars going on between countries using HAARP and various other technologies. That
And this is another example of something that I think the public should know about. Because, first of all, they're doing all kinds of things, as you know, chemtrails and everything. They're doing that so that they can keep things from warming up too much, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But these people don't know what they're doing.
Right.
And public money is being used to do all kinds of completely insane things.
Yep.
And we should have that information.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
It affects all of us, and anything that affects us, it really needs to be brought out in public discussions, we should be allowed to make a choice about it, but we're
Simon Appel is the New York Times reporter, and then his father is David Appel, who's a Jewish magus and a really wonderful intellectual.
Oh yeah.
And David knows that the current has stopped. So
oh, boy.
This is part of the timeline, 2011 to 2020.
Well, what is it that they say will happen if because there used to be dozens of currents that were keeping the weather stable, and they've slowed down to just a few, and now if it has slowed to stop, doesn't that signify like an instant freeze of the planet?
Well, then they put in a movie like The Day After.
Mm.
So what they do is they implant people with a movie like that, and then everybody thinks when they realize something's going on here, then they think of The Day After. It's not like that.
Now,
we certainly can expect some very rapid and intense levels of change. And I think that all of us need to be informed so that we can handle whatever we have to handle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, you know, you confuse the people by throwing The Day After at them, or Al Gore's hypothesis at them, and then they can't see what's actually happening. And so for anybody who's listening who gets kind of fearful about this, I'm not fearful.
Right.
Because if something's going to happen, it's going to happen. And I'm not going to sit around and be afraid of it, if you know what I mean. But
right.
I do think there's a lot of information that we can pick up at this point. Like for example, I think the way the climate is in your given region at this winter is probably the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so then you have to do whatever you have to do with your life to make changes or adjust to that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, it was also interesting. Today, the whole power grid went down. And so when I woke up, there was no power in the house, and it was so cold that I stayed in bed until it came back on so I could get heat going. Mm-hmm. And then it started hailing outside. So these little things are always clues to me that there's something happening. And the power came back on at 11:11 a.m.
So do you have a wood stove?
I do.
Good, because I think you're up in Northern California, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so you need a wood stove.
Yes, and that it's functional. It's not, you know, perfect, but it works, and it could certainly keep me warm for a little bit.
Yeah.
But like you said, we'll do what we have to do. And survival is always automatic.
Mm-hmm. And when the ages change, which is what we're in the middle of right now, it's climatic cycle changes are pretty typical. So if you go back in time, like I have in Catastrophobia, excuse me, there have been other periods where there's been climate change. And human cultures have done this or they've done that or whatever. This is part of living on Earth, you know.
Well, Barbara, you know, I could go on talking to you for hours, but, you know, we have reached the end of the show, and you have about a little bit of time to mention, you know, your website and what kinds of things that you'd like to mention at the end of the show.
Yeah, okay, well, my website is handcloud2012.com. H-A-N-D-C-L. If you just put Barbara Handclaw into the computer, comes up. And then Jerry and I, we come down to Southern California to the desert in the winter. So when we go back and forth, we teach. And so teachings are posted on our website. We're going to be appearing in California and then Oregon and Washington in a few weeks, as a matter of fact.
Oh, wonderful.
And, yeah, we're just teaching short classes and doing book signings and schmoozing with people.
Wonderful. And, of course, you'll be back in about a month to discuss the second part book of the trilogy. So we'll be gifted with your return in April.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that too, and I just want to thank you for sharing with us tonight, and I can't wait to get into that second book.
Well, thank you for having me, and people really should pick up Ruby Crystal before. It's with the trilogy, it's such a good idea to start with the first book.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Barbara. It was great talking to you again.
Thanks for having me, Lance.
All right. Good night, everybody.